Good morning to you. Welcome to the Daily Connection on KDove. It's a Thursday. It's 4 minutes after 10 o'clock, the final Thursday of the month, 26th it happens to be. And, you know, it's been our tradition here on the Daily Connection anyway, on the final Thursdays, to have those sporty church history lads, Matt and Chris, and
there we
to
go.
Talk about certain illustrious folks in our family heritage. And it's great to welcome you guys back again today.
Hey, good to be back again, Pat.
And,
I'd like to talk, but I'm still studying, so you guys go right
ahead. Okay. Well, an interesting person today, one that you might not pull out of the annals of Schaff's church history, but an interesting person because he's kind of a, well, there's a lot of street legends, you know, about this guy and,
absolutely,
and how the church has dissed science through this guy. And we're talking about Galileo.
Well, we all great Galileo, the humble server of mankind. You know, the post Renaissance, early Reformation school teacher who just had a yearning to discover new knowledge. Invented the telescope, ground his own lenses and turn them to the heavens to explore God's vast creation, and discovering there that totally apart from the what we thought was going on, you know, with the Earth at the center of the universe, lo and behold, the sun's at the center and we're going around it. And in carrying this exciting news out to the world, the evil College of Cardinals and that nasty Pope, not fearing the outbreak of truth, squashed him and brutalized him, threw him in the dungeon, tortured him on the rack, and
anti-science, heavy-handed,
plunging of course the entire world into the dark ages.
Chaos.
Science not recovering for probably several hundred years.
High interest rates, inflation.
You know, Galileo, a martyr to the cause of
absolutely
human
progress.
There's just one little problem with this story.
Well, now, what part of this story is not true, though, Matt? I mean, there's obviously, we've got the story. Everybody's heard it. We've read this in our history
grade
books
school,
in high school.
High school.
You know, it almost sounds like the Scopes monkey trial in a way, doesn't it?
It really does.
The harmless teacher who is just in the pursuit of truth gets squelched out by the religious establishment once again, just at an earlier era.
What a coincidence, the similarities, you know?
Absolutely.
Well, basically, let's start with the reality. First, Galileo was not the first to postulate the fact that the sun was the center of the solar system. This was 2,000 years old, 2,500 years old. This had first been postulated by Pythagoras, you know, back before the Lord's time, and was done with Ptolemy, finally ended up Copernicus just about 50 years before Galileo. And the time frame we're talking about here is the mid-1500s to the mid-1600s. Basically what has happened, the Reformation is kind of, the worst parts of the Reformation are mostly over. It's kind of winding down. We're moving into the Enlightenment period. And it was an old, the sun at the center was an old idea by the time Copernicus and then Galileo got their hands on it.
And one of the other things, of course, that is certainly not true about Galileo is he is not the person who invented the telescope. That was actually invented in Holland. And yes, Galileo messed around with telescopes and actually improved a few of them, but he's not the father of the telescope, nor is he the father of astronomy as we know it. He was not the one who pointed his telescope to the stars. As a matter of fact, he improved it for really more military purposes. It was in England where telescopes were first being used to study the stars. So he is not the the first person to sit in his lonely villa and look out the window at the stars either.
And not only that, I hate to say this, but he did not drop two balls from the Leaning Tower of Pisa.
I'm so thankful that I didn't get to bring that in. I'm so thankful I didn't get to bring that in.
We had to protect you from yourself.
Do you realize that the Leaning Tower of Pisa, do you realize that that has been leaning for well over 1,000 years?
It's been a long time.
It's amazing. It was actually 400 years old. The Leaning Tower of Pisa was actually 400 years old in Galileo. He would have thought, with as smart a person as he was, being a resident of Pisa, that he would have figured out a way to, you know, with all of his science, to straighten that thing up.
Can you imagine the revenue we would have generated on special permits if that were in Jackson County?
Absolutely.
I'm
That's
telling
amazing.
You. Oh, the county.
But we digress.
Yes. Not only did he not drop the two balls off the Leaning Tower of Pisa, he did not invent the pendulum. He was not persecuted by the Inquisition. He was not thrown in the dungeon.
there's quite a bit about the story of Galileo that just ain't there.
Well, as a matter of fact, when you get down to the real story about Galileo, it's really kind of boring.
What did he do, Christopher?
Well, he invented the protractor.
Whoa!
Oh, the thing that makes the circles on the page, huh?
Exactly, you know, and once again, he made a lot of money off of that, actually.
Yes, he
Galileo
did.
Was actually a very wealthy man and made a whole boatload of dough off the Hubble protractor.
Didn't he invent the barometer as well?
And we believe possibly the thermometer, the barometer, and all
so
that.
So he did. He was an inventor.
Leon Hunsaker, where would he have been without the barometer or the thermometer there? So, you know, I mean, it's awesome.
Now, I do know that when he turned his gaze to the heavens, Galileo also did discover sunspots. He is the first one to document the phases of the moons of Jupiter and of Venus, and was the first to theorize the landscape on the lunar surface, rather than just having it be a smooth sphere.
And this was an important thing, because this begins to call into question the popular science of the day, which was basically based on the philosopher Aristotle's idea that the heavenly realm, the heavens, in other words, outer space and everything, was a fixed and perfect place. And that actually, the world was actually one of the lowest points of order in the universe, and it was, you know, beneath the heavenly and celestial realm. And here Galileo comes in, and he begins to see that there is imperfection, quote-unquote, in outer space, which calls into question Aristotelian philosophy.
Blemishes on the heavenly bodies. My goodness. And I want folks to understand how big this was. Aristotle had ruled the academic world for 1,500 years. You just didn't question Aristotle. If Aristotle said it, I mean, it's kind of like the Bible for the Christian community today. If it's in there, well, what's your problem? But Galileo was making observations that really kind of were arousing the ire, not of the church,
but of the the academy,
the university.
And the real foil is not really any opposition to the Bible. The real foil was opposition to Aristotelian philosophy, which, of course, once again, the church itself was becoming heavily entrenched in as well, as far as theology and all that, but definitely within the academy.
Remember,
but basically, when we talk about Galileo, the upshot of the story is he's basically a boring math teacher at a university in Reformation Venice, and he is a very faithful churchman.
A good Christian guy.
Good Christian guy, but, you know, a faithful, loyal member of the Roman Catholic Church in his day.
So how did he become so famous? How do we have the story of him being grilled by the Inquisition and everything? Well, it's kind of funny. Because actually, both Copernicus, 50 years before, although they thought that this was true, that the sun is at the center of the solar system, they really didn't have good evidence for it. It's just a theory. The evidence wasn't discovered, what, 100
till
years?
Until 1833 that was conclusively proved.
Just didn't have the data to back it up. So it was a hypothesis, and that's all it could really be. And when he published this originally in 1613, he really feared ridicule from his fellow teachers, his fellow faculty members, and rightly so, because it was kind of a crackpot idea. And it wasn't that it violated biblical integrity. Actually, the whole idea of the earth at the center was more an Aristotelian idea than a biblical idea. As a matter of fact, all the church fathers had taken great pains to explain that when you interpret the Bible, you don't interpret it as an astronomical textbook. From St. Augustine on down the way, they all said, you guys, when the Lord speaks of the sun rising, you know, or Joshua, the sun standing still for Joshua, the Lord's using terms that explain it to the common reader of Scripture.
Hebrew uses a more descriptive language. It explains things phenomenologically, as opposed to literally and mathematically. And that's one of the problems a lot of people have, a stumbling point a lot of people do have with the Bible, is the idea that it needs to be interpreted in such a way as a science book, and yet it was never intended that way.
Yeah, they're just parts of the Bible where God intends for us to understand something, and he uses a simplified picture. You know, he doesn't have an arm, but his arm isn't shortened because we understand what that means. So anyway, the church did not really have a problem with this. But as Galileo forwards this idea and publishes it, the faculty at the University of Pisa and at Venice get really uptight, and they don't like what he's doing. So they send it to the Inquisition in a sealed manila envelope plain brown paper.
Did they have vanilla envelopes in those days? I don't think so.
It was a different type of adhesive that they used. Well, anyway, the Inquisition looked at it and said, oh, this is no big deal. This is fine. You know, go ahead. Publish this carefully. Don't call it reality. You know, don't reinterpret Bible verses and stuff like
that.
Keep
it in the realm of a hypothesis.
Yeah, just let's keep this as a discussion. That is a scientifically reasonable thing. And you have to admit, it is. That's
what we fair, especially given the fact that at the time, they really didn't know
for a
fact.
So anyway, Galileo sort of misinterpreted this and took it. He understood it to give him a little more license than he thought he had, and that he probably would have gotten away with it. But by the time he was almost 70 years old, he finally sums all this up in a nice little theory called a dialogue. And it's between two people, two hypothetical fictional characters. One is a very erudite, sharp, smart, urbane man.
Resembling very much Galileo.
Resembling Galileo. What a coincidence. Who is speaking for the sun at the center theory. And he's talking with a simplistic, moronic, pompous idiot.
Who resembles very much the Pope at the time.
What a coincidence. Who uses some of the Pope's own arguments. And so he publishes this. He was not a very politically sensitive man. He just wasn't aware of some of the nuances.
Yeah.
And the Pope was his old buddy. The Pope had supported him as a cardinal, had patronized him for years, and helped him in his career.
And he was a pensioner of the church. He actually lived off of church income.
So when the Pope finally gets around to reading this and recognizes his own words in the mouth of the simpleton...
Simplico was the character's
Simplico,
name.
He just... You know, he gets a little understandably hackled at this and calls Galileo in. And the Inquisition kind of grills him a little bit, and they basically end up slapping him on the wrist. They don't throw him in the dungeon. They do put him under house arrest in the luxurious, it's what, like minimum security for government prisoners these days.
With servants.
Tennis courts and things like that.
With servants, probably a sauna, you name it.
And Galileo was happy with that. You know, he did recant, and he said, yeah, I came on a little strong there. But this was not about science being crushed by the church. That just has no part whatsoever in this whole entire story.
He also, interestingly, did run by the board of review basically for the Roman Catholic Church. A lot of the things that he wrote, and just as a course of action, and they all passed muster. He was not asked to edit or make, you know, great changes and things that he did. So it's kind of an interesting thing also to point out that when we talk about Galileo and the Inquisition, it should not be understood as the same thing as the Spanish Inquisition. It was the Roman Inquisition, which never really ever handed out the death penalty, was more of a heresy group in literature and you know, basically covered doctrinal issues, where the Spanish Inquisition was more focused on getting rid of people, making people disappear, torture, all the things that you get with the, you know, the horrific part of the Inquisition was more the Spanish Inquisition.
Which was blown quite a bit out of proportion anyway. I remember the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre took out more people in one day than the Spanish Inquisition did in 40 years.
I know, but it doesn't make for good movies.
I'm sorry. Gosh. Didn't want to get us messed up with truth or anything, you know. Really.
All right, so the Inquisition, Now, he was given the sanction by the Pope, go ahead, publish your stuff, and the academicians were the ones that were, you know, you're going way out on a limb here, right?
There was a vested interest in that party line of Aristotelian philosophy.
They lose all their grants from National Geographic and the National Science Foundation, you know, if their theories are proven wrong, so they're not happy.
Which, of course, is something that even occurs today. If you do not toe the party line in the scientific community... There is a party line. It's called evolution today.
People
that don't seem to fit that paradigm find themselves under ridicule,
suddenly,
scrutiny, you know, all sorts of
with their
problems.
Research funds withdrawn.
That's right.
What an amazing thing. Golly. Well, you know, why do we remember Galileo, Pat? What, you know, is this guy actually worth, you know, evaluating and looking at as a contributor? And you know what? He really is. He stands out. What people don't understand is that really Christianity gave birth to the Renaissance. It was the efforts, the intellectual efforts of the church that really brought the fruition of Renaissance to full maturity. And from that, the Enlightenment. You know, people want to say that we're escaping, you know, the church's, discouragement of intellectual exploration, that's bunk. The church is what stimulated that. That's where it came from. As a matter of fact, we have to call Galileo. We were talking about that this morning. Galileo was one of the pioneers. He's one of the first guys that escaped from that that whole Aristotle, figure it out in your head type of science, what was called science then, and actually said, no, you know what, we need to actually do some experiments here and make some observations and check this out, write it down. As a matter of fact, it was Christian natural philosophers who integrated mathematics into science, who integrated experimentation into it. See, one of the things people don't understand is they expected to find patterns and natural laws that were harmonious, because that's God's nature.
Can I interject? There's another significant...
I wish you wouldn't.
Are you Mike Hogging it again, Matt? Another thing, though, about Aristotle is the fact that actually, if anything, that set back the cause of science, because the significance
goodness, yes,
of being able to find, you know, make hypothesis and back that up was before it depended entirely upon human reason.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with that is not that human reason is a necessarily completely faulty or bad thing, but human reason is fallen. And as such, because if you lean upon that alone, you can end up in some very weird ideas and very weird trails if that is all you're depending on alone. Where here, with the experimental science advocated by Galileo and others, it allowed people to actually begin to think God's thoughts after him. The whole idea that there was order helped them to follow along lines beyond just human reason.
Absolutely.
And that's where at least the notion of some progress came about.
And in terms of comparing with other cultures, I mean, that is why you do not find great scientific development in any of the other cultures. The Islamic culture had a century or two where they did really well. The Chinese culture went for a while and then just kind of plateaued and pooped out in terms of scientific development. All of these cultures and civilizations are given over to a cyclic way of thinking, which kind of leads you, well, it's all hopeless. We're just all going to stay in the same place anyway. It's only in the Christian worldview that you really grapple and get a hold of the idea of we're progressing. There's a linear progression involved here from a beginning to an end, and that there is a harmony underlying what we see with and perceive with our senses. So it's really the Christian scientists were equipped to do this. All these guys, Johannes Kepler, Robert Boyle, the father of chemistry, Isaac Newton, we've all heard, only the most brilliant human being to walk the face of the planet ever. You know, Anton von Leeuwenhoek, the father of microbiology, the inventor of the microscope, Blaise Pascal, our old buddy. The list is endless. All of these guys were devout Christians looking for evidence of God's creative pattern.
Well then, Matt, if that's the case, and Christians were so involved in science, why is it that today there's a virtual divorce between science and Christianity?
You know, Chris, I'm glad you asked that question.
Almost like you had read my notes.
You know, basically, where all this came from, I love going back in history and tracking down, why do we think what we think?
Mm-hmm.
What caused this? And the idea that there's a warfare or a big conflict between faith actually comes from a specific source. And in reaction to the Reformation Catholic Church, the French Enlightenment thinkers, not the scientists, but some of the scholars and everything, the philosophers, came. When they built in the mid-1700s, the French L'Encyclopédie, they listed these stories of Galileo being persecuted, among other things, and really built a horrible picture of church persecution of intellectual exploration and freedom. Well, these things were picked up by the time it got over to the United States. Probably the one single guy that we have to single out is in the late 1800s, the first president of Cornell University, Andrew White.
No relative of mine.
No. I'm glad. We have to whip on you. Wrote a book, The History of Warfare Between Science and Theology in Christendom.
Hmm.
And he just frankly, he was a liberal Christian who had been put down because he wanted to institute a lot of secular classes at Cornell, and the church authorities weren't happy about that. So as a backlash, he really lambasted the church in this history book and just made things up. Just, oh my gosh, he's got Luther and Calvin objecting to the Copernican Galileo observation. He's got, oh, I, I, we could go on for hours, but just frankly, this is a horrible piece of scholastic work. But it provided so many useful stories to the liberal folks trying to put Christianity down and create this myth that they continue to use it. It's still in print today. Our high school texts take a lot of their examples from White's book. I mean, this is, you can actually identify, this is one book through which a lot of this has come. And this set us up for the Scopes Monkey Trial. This set us up, John Draper was another guy in that time period that wrote a similar book. But even though they don't have much connection with reality, anybody that's got an axe to grind against the church or wants to present this myth of the church against science, they just quote these guys. And it doesn't matter that the quotes are completely false.
Even Carl Sagan, with his billions and billions of years ago, even he got on the bandwagon against Galileo, you know. I wonder if Sagan thinks today that the only thing there is the cosmos.
I'll bet he does, by golly. I doubt we'll see him when we get home. Well, it's frustrating, but it's also exciting to realize this is a human phenomena that really is something the spirit can come against. And really, in this day and age, there's a huge upsurge, again, in Christian scholasticism and philosophy. And we look everywhere, science is really proving, my gosh, archaeology is proving the Bible every single day. You know, evolution is on just about complete retreat. I don't have time for some of the fun stories about what the excuses that some of the university biology teachers are using when they get to the chapter on evolution, and they just kind of have to hang their head and say, let's not argue about this, okay? Let's just press on. But it's in retreat because God is not afraid of the truth. It's his creation, and real science is devoted to finding that. And real scientists aren't afraid of what they'll find, and neither are real Christians.
And there's not a conflict. Even Galileo said that there is really not a conflict between the Bible and science. And actually, the Bible and science has created today a real problem with science. Science divorced from God, divorced from any accountability, moral parameters, or ethics, has caused as many problems, probably, as it has created good out of it. And that's because man was not intended to go and do things that are just right only in his own eyes, apart from any accountability to a higher authority.
You know, without the direction of the Spirit, really, science is so powerful, it's a bull in the china shop. I mean, we have atomic power, we're blowing things up, you know, we're cloning. Who knows where genetic engineering will go? You know, the Nazis were loving that. They would have loved that. They could have created a real master race. You know, global warming, food poisoning, starvation, Bhopal gas poisonings. You know, all of this stuff is science without a rudder. It's science without a moral reference point. And even the scientists are starting to nod their heads and go, you know, this, something's wrong here. We're running into problems. This should be a better world, better living through chemistry.
You'd think there'd be more progress than there really
is. And they're not. We're in trouble. And we need to do something.
Well, excellent ideas. Excellent thoughts there. You know, you get your soft sciences, psychology and sociology, and you're talking real science with real people, and you have to go to the philosophy department anymore to find folks that will support, you know.
Amen. Some of those. Good philosophy always makes for a healthy mind. That's what I say.
Well, and that's what, you know, you talked about those books. That's what's happening in the movie theaters today.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
You're getting philosophy. You're getting nihilism, or you're getting Buddhism. You're getting one of those, whether you know it or not. But anyway, you got a book to talk about.
Absolutely. Just before we close, I want to recommend, as we always do, a resource. And one of the books that we have really glommed onto, if we used it in classes, is a book called Six Modern Myths About Christianity and Western Civilizations by Philip Sampson. And
fabulous,
it covers the Galileo story, but also many of the other well-worn shibboleths that are taught in any Western Civ class. And it's an excellent, excellent recommend. Well worth anybody's time reading. It's out by InterVarsity Press. I don't think we get a kickback for saying that, but anyway, that's a great thing.
All right. Thank you guys for that look into the real story of Galileo and discussion a little bit about science in the church. So we're going to do it again next month, and I think it's Charlemagne. I look forward to that. It's too bad we have to wait a month, but we will anyway. So thanks again, Matt McAuliffe and Chris White, both on staff at Trail Christian Fellowship. I'm Pat Daly. Thanks for joining us here today on KDOV.
You cannot excuse